From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. There's been talk of Billary, that would be Bill and Hillary Clinton, but what about Clobama or O'Binton? The two remaining Democratic presidential candidates, Senators Clinton and Obama, played nice at last night's debate in Los Angeles.
I also want to note that I was friends with Hillary Clinton before we started this campaign. I will be friends with Hillary Clinton after this campaign is over.
Does that mean they've heard the message from Democratic Party insiders that they shouldn't tear themselves down before, well, the Republicans get to tear one of them down in the general election? For more on the debate and the race, we've got Democratic strategist Jamal Simmons. He was press secretary for the presidential campaigns of both Senator Bob Graham and General Wesley Clark. And we have Republican strategist Angela McGlowan. She's an analyst for Fox News and author of the best-selling book Bamboozled: How Americans Are Being Exploited by the Lies of the Liberal Agenda. Jamal and Angela, welcome back.
Thank you for having us.
So some folks expected last night's showdown to be a smackdown. Angela, were you surprised by what happened?
No, I wasn't surprised. And you know what? I'm glad to see that they did kiss and make up, because there is a saying, united we stand, divided we fall. And being a black woman, I saw a lot of division in the black community because of the Obama Clinton situation. So I'm glad that they kept it civil, because even though I am Republican and I'm a strategist for the Republican Party, I want to have an intelligent debate so people can make a decision, not on emotion, not on race baiting, but actually on the issues.
Jamal, in terms of issues, there have been times when the focus was more on the economy, including in this week's Republican debate. But last night, there was a lot of talk about the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Senator Obama has repeatedly pointed out that he was opposed to the war from the start. Let's listen to a comment from last night.
I think it is much easier for us to have the argument when we have a nominee who says, I always thought this was a bad idea, this was a bad strategy. And that is an argument that I think we are going to have a easier time making if they can't turn around and say, but hold on a second, you supported this. And that's part of the reason why I think that I would be the strongest nominee on this argument of national security.
You know, some people have said, including some of the analysts we have on the show, that there's less of a distinction between, for example, Senator John McCain and Senator Hillary Clinton than there is between Senator John McCain's views on the wars and Senator Obama. Is Obama actually going to benefit from this issue? Is this something, you know, especially given the economic issues being so close to people's hearts, is this something that's really a selling point for him?
It is something that's a selling point for him. It's mostly the reason why he got into the race, I think, to get started, was to start to talk about this issue. And it's the reason why people started to like him. Senator Obama's in a pretty good place when it comes to the issue of the war on Iraq, and also, I think, the general issue, which is leadership and judgment, which is where he's really trying to make his case. So that's the place where voters are, he's trying to get voters to make the judgment about him, that it's not as much about experience if you don't have good judgment. He's got good judgment, and they should count on him, is his argument.
Now, Angela, when you think about health care, this is an issue that Senator Hillary Clinton has taken some ownership of well before she was a senator. Is this something that you think that Senator Clinton can use to her advantage? And what did you hear last night?
She can use that to her advantage. Listen, she's a brilliant lady. And when it comes down to policy and the issues on actually enacting policy, she beats Obama hands down. Now, I'm not for her plan. I'm not for the universal health care plan. But you're right. When she was first lady in the 90s, that was her issue of passion, and it still is. Now, she wants to have a universal health care mandate, and people don't sign up for her program, if she's president, they will be fined. Whereas Obama, he wants federal funding, yes, but he also wants to have the American people to have a choice. So he also wants partial subsidies to provide for a private plan. But at the end of the day, last night in the debate, she showed that she had more policy experience. And people are emotional about the war. But Obama hasn't really come up with a plan on terrorism. And she, in essence, has stood the test of time.
Jamal, what about money? There has been a lot of talk about how the Democrats right now are actually in a better financial position than the Republicans, speaking of the candidates. Are both of these candidates equally matched to basically put out their message through television. At a Super Tuesday is a time where no matter how many places these folks go, they cannot simultaneously be in over 20 states at once. And so that means television ads are a big part of this. Are both of these candidates up for that challenge?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We don't know what how much money Senator Clinton has raised lately. There was a report this week that Senator Obama has now raised $32 million in January alone. He's on the air in 20 states that are having contests on February 5th, and then he's going up on the air in 12 more states that are having contests in the next week or so of February. So Senator Obama is certainly raising a lot of money. I would assume Senator Clinton is fine on money. She also has an advantage on name ID already and on general popularity. You know, what's funny is there's not a lot of new information to learn about Hillary Clinton. The Democrats and the American public have been, you know, hearing Senator Clinton and Hillary Clinton's name now for 16 years, and people feel like they know her. I think she can remind them. She can remind them of the good things. She can make a good impression by putting out some ads. But she's not going to change some core impressions about herself with a few TV ads. Obama's in a different position. A lot of people don't know him. It's the reason why his poll numbers are just now starting to come up. So he's actually got to introduce himself to people and counter whatever they may be hearing that's negative in the news media.
Angela, but what about that? You know, having a prior record, so to speak, mm-hmm. can cut both ways. And although I've seen some Republicans actually saying that they would vote for Hillary over McCain, and, you know.
Hillary over McCain?
Yeah.
Some Republicans have said that?
Yes, some Republicans have said that, as well as some people saying that they would vote for McCain over Hillary on the Democratic side. But
in any event.
But what I'm saying is there's a lot of, from what I understand from polls, a lot of negatives that many Republican voters have about Senator Hillary Clinton. That whole question of having a track record, does that cut against her in some ways?
I think it actually helps her. At the end of the day, with the Super Tuesday process, I think it's going to come down to the Hispanic vote. And Hillary is reaching out to that community. Now, you had a very strong Hispanic organization that endorsed Obama yesterday regarding the illegal alien process and the immigration process. I think that a track record does count. But I think in this instance, it's going to actually help her. If you listen to the debate last night, Obama, yes, talked about hope. Yes, he can unify people. But at the end of the day, now it's going to come down to experience and who will be the best candidate. And I think that Hillary is going to actually be the Democrat nominee.
And now, before we move on, I had recalled this, but just wanted to look it up. Ann Coulter, who can mm-hmm. hardly be called a liberal, has said that she would back Hillary Clinton over John McCain. We can talk about that some other time, but I just wanted to point out she's certainly a prominent Republican and conservative. But I want to move on to something you just mentioned, which is mm-hmm. the immigration issue. Mm-hmm. Senator Obama was asked about the negative economic impact of immigration on the black community, mm-hmm. and here was part of his response.
Before the latest round of immigrants showed up, you had huge unemployment rates among African-American youth. And so I think to suggest somehow that the problem that we're seeing in inner city unemployment, for example, is attributable to immigrants, I think is a case of scapegoating that I do not believe it. I do not subscribe to it.
Now, Jamal, do you think that that was a risky position for Senator Obama, given especially that Hillary has said that jobs have been lost in this situation?
Well, I don't think it's a risky position over the next 2 weeks. We'll see what happens in the fall. It may be a different story. I think Barack Obama's got a lot of ground to make up with Hispanic and Latino voters. And so he's doing he is communicating in a way that will appeal to them. I think if African-Americans were African-Americans who are a little bit more in line with working-class whites when it comes to immigration, I doubt that they'll vote against Barack Obama because of his immigration position.
Well, Jamal, I have to respectfully disagree. In the Delta part of Mississippi, you have a lot of undocumented workers helping rebuild the casinos. In the Delta part of Mississippi, you have a high percentage of unemployed blacks that could do those unskilled labor jobs if those casinos would go into the community and recruit. Let's look at New York. You have 45% unemployment among black males, but yet and still, Elliot Spitzer wants to give illegal aliens driver's licenses. I think that this issue does divide the black community. And when undocumented workers are hired, they do get paid less.
Angela, I don't disagree with you that it's not an important issue in the community and there aren't people who care about it. I just don't think it's going to be the issue that turns African-American voters away from Senator Obama in this contest.
I don't know. They might go more on the lines of Hillary because I do think that this issue does divide the black and Hispanic community, and you do have a lot of unemployment in our inner city among black males, and undocumented workers are taking those jobs.
All right. We are winding down, and I want this to be very quick. Angela, then Jamal, yes. Do you ever see either a Clobama or an O'Benton ticket? Would one of them play second fiddle to the other as a Veep candidate?
You know, Angela. What? At the end of the day, they need to beat Republicans. You know, if the Democrats want to do that, and I think that it would be a very powerful ticket. But in the end, I think Republicans are going to win.
Yeah, I don't think you'd have an Obama and Clinton ticket. I'm going to, this may be a little politically incorrect here, but I just think that's maybe a little bit too much change for America to handle all at once.
You can have one candidate of change, but you just can't have two, huh?
Yeah, I think
it'd be
having
powerful,
one of them on the ticket is going to be enough change for people to have to swallow. And so I'd look for a good, moderate Southern or Midwestern white male.
Sounds like John Edwards. Anyway, on that note, Angela, Jamal, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
We've been speaking with Fox News political analyst Angela McLaughlin. She joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., and Democratic political strategist Jamal Simmons, who spoke with us from Washington. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The nation's top attorney won't make a legal call on waterboarding, at least not yet. But Attorney General Michael Mukasey did say if the CIA was to make the move to use the interrogation tactic again, the president would have to be notified and he would make sure that Congress knew what was going on. That's left Congress fuming, but what's the next move? To talk about this week's top news stories, we've got Michael Fletcher. He is a national economics reporter and former White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Marcus Mabry, the international business editor for the New York Times, and Adora Udoji, the co-host of The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji, a new public radio program launching this spring. Hi, folks.
Hey, how are you?
Hi. Hey there.
So let's go to waterboarding. Last October, then Attorney General nominee Michael Mukasey said he would offer his opinion on waterboarding once he'd been properly briefed. It's an interrogation tactic used by the U.S. government on suspected terrorists, and some people, including Senator Ted Kennedy, consider it torture. Well, Mukasey's confirmation has come and gone, and his answer is, it depends. So what does this mean, Adora? Was this just a big punt on his part?
I think it's been fascinating to watch this unravel, and it's my bet that the history books are not going to be terribly kind to this whole notion of legal relativism, if I could just get that out. I mean, this notion that somehow torture, the definition of what it is, depends on who it may benefit at any given time, it is really something unusual, and they certainly didn't teach that in law school when I was there.
Marcus, when you look at this ongoing debate, is this something that's going to help set future U.S. policy? I mean, there's been a whole slew of discussions over things like preemptive war and all these concepts of how the U.S. Constitution and U.S. government fits into the context of an age of terrorism and response to that. Is this debate going to set U.S. policy?
Well, you know, Farai, this is one of the legacies, one of the many negative legacies of the George W. Bush presidency. And I think whoever the next president of the United States is, we're going to see a reversal of many Bush policies, and this will be one of them. There will be an unequivocal, shortly after the next president is sworn in, an unequivocal statement that U.S. policy is that we do not engage in torture, we do not engage in illegal activities, and waterboarding is definitely one of those. We'll see a bunch of reversals, I think, too, of lots of executive privileges that the Bush administration has taken on, has decided that the president has the power to go around the courts, to ignore the Congress, and to decide issues unilaterally. I think all that kind of policy nonsense will evaporate with this president. And it's a negative legacy. And I think the next president, whether Republican or Democrat, will spend a lot of time reversing that Bush legacy.
Michael, the Wall Street Journal recently reported on a group of three young men who videotaped one of them being waterboarded. The mock detainee was 26-year-old Jean-Pierre LaRocque, who later blogged about the experience, and his blog is called Media for Social Change. He explained that he and his friends wanted to witness firsthand the effects of the tactic. He's a swimmer, and he said that he had trouble lasting even a few minutes while being waterboarded. Now, here's a couple of questions. One, are LaRocque and his pals activists or citizen journalists or both? And are they kind of calling out bigger media companies for not exploring this issue deeply enough from the side of what human beings endure?
Well, I think they have to be called activists in this case. And I think they're also right, because I think they're trying to bring some kind of sort of clearer image to waterboarding. I think most of us just have no idea what's involved here. And that whole area of kind of harsh interrogation, as the Bush administration might put it, is something that's a very, very obscure to most Americans. And I think their work is trying to bring some form to this.
Now, Michael, I'm going to stick with you for a second. This is something that is affecting people across the country. We're talking about mortgages. And the FBI recently announced an investigation into 14 companies involved in the subprime loan business. And insider trading and accounting fraud are two of the big issues they're looking for. So these mortgages are bought and sold between companies. How hard is it going to be to pin culpability on any one organization?
Well, it's going to be – I'll be interested to see how this investigation kind of progresses, because – not only are mortgages bought and sold now, then now they're repackaged into securities that are sold across the globe. So the trail of money, you know, literally circles the earth. So, and a lot of this business is unregulated, and that's been part of the big problem with what we've seen with the credit crunch and mortgage crisis that the country is facing now. Essentially, people don't know who's holding the bag, who's going to end up losing money, and the result has been that many lenders have pulled back. So, you know, it's not sort of fraud probably in the sense that you think of people lying on a mortgage application, even though there seems to be plenty of that to go around as well. But it'll be interesting to see. My guess is that you won't see a lot of indictments in the end, at least on the secondary part of this. You might see the front end where you have a lot of instances where you have homeowners who are now kind of underwater of their homes, saying that mortgage brokers encouraged them to lie about their income, overstate their income, they didn't seek to document their income, that sort of thing. I think those cases will be easier to prove, but I'll be interested to see what happens with sort of the broader kind of securities piece of this.
Adora, you are in this position of getting ready to start something, start your show, and you're going to be based in New York City. New York City in some ways has been insulated because there's so many people who want to buy there. There hasn't been as much fallout. But how do you want to approach this? Once your show gets launched on WNYC, how do you want to dig into this issue?
Oh, I think there are so many different levels to it. I guess I'm very much with Michael in that it'll be interesting to see what becomes of the FBI investigation as well as the SEC. So that's one element, of course, that we'd be following. But more importantly, I think we'd like to really take a look at how this is affecting people. We all see the charts, we see the numbers, but what does this really mean? We've even seen some pictures of neighborhoods where every other house is for sale. But in terms of everyday life, we know when we take a look at some of the latest projections that there are going to be plenty more people finding themselves in tough positions in the next 6-12 months. And so how does that change their life? How does it change the decisions that they're making about their lives for their families? So I think that we're going to take a look at this from just about every single angle.
Marcus, when it comes down to investigating things like this, a lot of times you have people coming from different agencies. So we're talking about the FBI, but also Securities and Exchange, and then individual state attorney generals are going to get in on the action. Is that going to help, or is that going to muddy the issue?
Well, that's a great question, Farai. I mean, you know, it's one of these things. You know, I was based in South Africa when they were dealing with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, dealing with the crimes of apartheid. And one of the underpinnings of that was that you would not get justice if you were a victim of apartheid, but you would get truth. The truth would be brought out. No one would necessarily go to jail. And if you admitted to your crimes, that was the whole point. You would not go to jail. So that one has, I think, to choose here in this grave crisis in this country, as one had to choose in South Africa at that point, between exposing what happened happen and actually bringing people to justice. I don't think we're going to bring anyone to justice. I think the horse has already left the barn. I think those who are suffering, who are underwater now, who were the victims of fraudulent mortgage lenders in particular, obviously investors who were then sold these bad mortgages that were securitized into debt that could be traded and was sold. Literally, that debt was sold all across the world. We did a story not long ago in the paper about a little village in Norway that finds itself broke because they invested in subprime when they thought it was actually grade A, triple A quality debt, and it wasn't. So I think the damage is done. I think the most we can do now is hope that these investigations will bring to light what happened, where we went wrong. Because the next time we have, once again, you know, the Fed right now is trying to loosen credit so that people will keep extending credit and taking out credit. The next time we have too much credit, right now we have too little, and the pendulum always swings back and forth. We're going to need to know what do we need to look out for to make sure people don't abuse the loose credit that's going to come again one day. That's a long way from now, but we need to find out how these things happen.
Marcus, you used the term underwater, and so did Michael. Just real quick, there is this lawsuit, federal judge threw out, involving the Army Corps of Engineers in the levee break during Hurricane Katrina. There were 500,000 claims by businesses, government entities, and residents, and the judge said that although the Corps failed to protect the city, the law does not hold them accountable. Is this a blow, yet another blow, to the people who've been battered by Katrina, and do you think this will affect the future of the city?
I think it is a blow. I think if you talk about, again, you know, justice, which is never repaid, I think the tragedy of New Orleans and of Katrina is exactly that. It's justice that will never be. There will never be justice for the crimes that were committed there, largely, as this case alleged, by our own government and its own incompetence. Unfortunately, there will not be retribution. And unfortunately, once again, those folks are abandoned. I think as a matter of law, and I didn't go to law school like you, Dora, but as a matter of law, I think, you know, this relies on the Flood Control Act of 1928, which actually indemnified the government, said the government would not be liable for any failures in levees and systems that it set up. So I think as a matter of law, it seems pretty clear-cut. But again, as a matter of justice, that's another issue.
Adora, since you do have a law background, is this something – what's the plan B? Is anyone going to be able to sue someone else, some other government entity on some other grounds?
Well, I think Marcus said it exactly right. There's really two tracks here. The law, it does appear to be very clear, and it's not unusual that government entities and agencies are immune, you know, immune from legal action of this kind. I guess I was actually there in New Orleans during Katrina and sort of saw very firsthand the absolute incompetence that built those levees in the Army Corps of Engineers. And there's no question, and the judge noted that in his decision. But the question is, what comes next now? In terms of suing other people, as we all know, there's lots of litigation going on with insurance companies. And that will continue for some time. There's other litigation involving some of the federal insurance programs as well. So that's one tract towards justice. But I think that what's most important, or what is very important up there in that priority list, is that what is the Army Corps of Engineers going to do now in the work that they are doing on those levees? Are they going to be held to a higher level of accountability than they have been in the past?
Michael, very quickly, what's the next step for reporters? What's, you know, what should reporters be reporting on regarding New Orleans and the Gulf?
You know, I've been in New Orleans probably 7 or 8 times in the wake of Katrina, and it's always shocking to go down there and see the state of the rebuilding and how slowly things mm-hmm. are moving. And I think it's kind of our charge to kind of keep that in the spotlight, you know, keep the rebuild, keep the sort of pressure on the people responsible for the rebuilding programs and make sure that that federal money, more than $100 billion, flows into the hands of New Orleans citizens.
All right. Well, gentlemen, lady, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Fletcher is national economics reporter and former White House correspondent for The Washington Post. He joined us via phone on assignment in Arizona. Marcus Mabry is the international business editor for The New York Times and joined us from NPR's New York Bureau. And Adora Udoji is co-host of The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji, a new public radio program launching this spring. And she joined us from WNYC in New York. For many of us, film can be a mirror. Sometimes we see ourselves as we are, and sometimes when we look at the blockbusters or indie films, we see ourselves through a funhouse mirror. It reflects who we'd like to be or even what we hate. All this month, we're looking at African-American images in film and at the people in front of the camera and behind the scenes. Today, we're going to take a historical overview on how African-Americans have been portrayed. Joining me now, Esther Ibarram. She wrote We Gotta Have It, 20 Years of Seeing Black at the Movies, 1986 to 2006. She also founded and edits SeeingBlack.com. And Thomas Cripps, professor emeritus at Morgan State University in Baltimore, Maryland. He's written several books on black cinema, including Black Film as Genre. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Welcome.
So, Esther, it's been almost a century since black audiences saw Birth of a Nation, directed by D.W. Griffith. And that film, 1915 film, is about families during the Civil War, arguably celebrating the Ku Klux Klan. I've seen it at different times. Is that really the kickoff of black images in film for you?
I think so. I think it is for most of us who think about film and write about film. It was probably the first film that was so widely distributed and had such an impact. You know, even if there were images before, it had such an impact in terms of how the community responded to it and how they kind of organized against it.
Now, when you think, Professor Cripps, of a movie like this, what did it take to, or when was the first time that we saw somewhat more nuanced, if not positive, images in film, and who did that come from?
Well, I think the first thing we have to think about with The Birth of a Nation is that black people saw it as well as white people and went after it with a zealousness, an uncommon zealousness. The NAACP had been a federation of loosely held together branches. In 1915, it became a nationwide body that, in fact, could take on the NAACP. That, in turn, inspired two black men in L.A. Who founded the Lincoln Motion Picture Company to make their own movies, roughly one a year for 5 years. And in turn, Oscar Michaud in 1919 made his first movie. So, in a sense, black action toward movies began with The Birth of a Nation, as well as what was on the screen that was appealing to a white audience as well.
When you think, Esther, about some of the earlier films that set a standard, films of the 1940s and 50s, what did they do to lay a foundation for later work by African-American filmmakers?
Well, I think, you know, just kind of picking up a little bit before we move to the 40s, in terms of Birth of a Nation, I think that, you know, when you really look at the problematic images in the film in terms of kind of solidifying this myth of the black rapist, the whole way in which, you know, educated or, you know, professional blacks were depicted as, you know, very kind of base savage-like, I think that, you know, it spurred not only the filmmakers to be more active, you know, as Professor Cripps mentioned, but it also spurred the consciousness of the audience to really think about how they're depicted, you know. And I think as you move further, you know, there's more of an emphasis on kind of correcting some of those things so that in later movies you have, you know, black women, you know, in particular, being depicted differently than they are in Birth of a Nation and the relationship between blacks and whites depicted differently.
Well, we're going to have to take a quick break, but I want you to stay with us because we're actually going to play a little bit of some key films. And I am with Esther Ibarram, who wrote We Gotta Have It, 20 Years of Seeing Black at the Movies, 1986 to 2006, plus Thomas Cripps, a professor emeritus at Morgan State University, author of several books, including Black Film as Genre. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We're back talking, as we will be all month, about blacks in film and on the screen. I'm with Esther Iverum. She wrote We Gotta Have It, 20 Years of Seeing Black at the Movies, 1986 to 2006. She also founded and edits SeeingBlack.com. And Thomas Cripps, professor emeritus at Morgan State University. He's written several books on black cinema. So welcome back. I'm going to jump right into this, and I want to take us to something specific. There are, you know, we talked a little bit about Birth of a Nation, which depicted African Americans from a white perspective, and then how the NAACP pushed back. I want to take us to perhaps a more nuanced image of black life in a film produced by white folks, To Kill a Mockingbird, starring Gregory Peck as the lawyer who defends Tom Robinson, a black man accused of raping a white woman. Actor Brock Peters played Tom in the 1962 film. Here's Tom in court.
Tom Robinson, take the stand.
Tom, were you acquainted with Mayella Violet Ewell?
Yes, sir. I had to pass her place going to and from the field every day.
Is there any other way to go?
No, sir. None I know of.
And did she ever speak to you?
Why, yes, sir. I'd tip my hat when I'd go by. And one day she asked me to come inside the fence and bust up a shiffer rope for her. She gave me the hatchet and I broke it up. And then she said, I reckon I'll have to give you a nickel, won't I? And I said, no, ma'am, there ain't no charge.
Professor Cripps, unpack that a little bit for us. What are we supposed to make of both Tom, the character, and Brock Peters, the actor, in terms of you know, their agency, their ability to exist as a character with some positive qualities and as an actor making decisions about roles?
Well, I admire Brock Peters' work in it and his work in general, but I despair of his getting only that role in the beginning, in the sense that it was a white Southerner's novel put into film in a way that made every white person, almost, sympathetic, intelligent, leaning toward the right thinking, whereas Tom gets killed in the end, so that the message contradicts itself.
Esther, do you think that the economics of the time or the social mores of the time pretty much required the black character to die, that there couldn't have been a white audience that would have responded to something that was more advantageous to the black character?
It's really hard for me to kind of think about the film in terms of how white audiences would react to it, you know? I guess I've spent so much of my time addressing a black audience and thinking about how we react to films that I don't, I guess that's where the disconnect comes in, you know?
Well, what about black audiences at the time? Do you think that there was probably a sense of disappointment?
Absolutely. I think of this film as being one of the early films that is, you know, ostensibly about the black experience, but it's not really about it. It really winds up being about the whites in the film and kind of like in detail about their kind of emotions and their, you know, and kind of portraying them as kind of the heroes and the ones that create the way and create an agency for the black character. You know, we've seen it in films, you know, during our lifetime, certainly, but this is one of the early films that kind of sets up that you know, pattern, you know, in a film to kind of, and the same film has been made over and over and over again.
Professor Cripps, I want to move on in a second to more modern films, but tell me a little bit about how black actors like Harry Belafonte negotiated the system. He actually had a distribution deal. Were some few people able to set up their own space?
Well, Belafonte is a lot like what used to be called race movie makers. They controlled the product from the beginning, raised their own money. It wasn't Harry, it was his firm, Harbell, just as Oscar Michaud founded his firm in 1919. Given that beginning of a film, it's going to be a black film and be one on its merits to black audiences as well as white. Without that, the only way to turn out a black film is during some moment of pressure or crisis, such as when black film came or black sound came to films in 1929. Bessie Smith made a movie in that year, St. Louis Blues, that to this day rings with authenticity and brilliance that she brought to it, she and J.C. Handy, whose music it is. Apart from movies like that, you cannot look at a Hollywood movie and expect to see black.
Now, we're basically doing like a full tilt run through the history of black cinema, and I appreciate you guys running with this. I want to fast forward to films today. We have clips from two recent films, The Great Debaters, directed by and starring Denzel Washington, and First Sunday, starring Ice Cube, Cat Williams, and Tracy Morgan.
Debate is blood sport. You must destroy your opponent, not only verbally, but physically. I am here to help you to find and keep your righteous mind.
We didn't come here to hurt nobody. All we want is the money.
This is not even my church. I saw this on MySpace.
Open up that safe.
It's gone.
The money we came to steal, somebody stole it.
Who would steal money from a church?
Esther, two different looks at films from African Americans for African Americans. First Sunday did great at the box office. Great Debaters was nominated for Golden Globe Awards, but not for any Oscars. What are these films? One a comedy caper with stereotypes, and the other a film about triumph over adversity, say about what black audiences and filmmakers are able to do at this point.
Well, the first thing it says to me is, you know, I interviewed Spike Lee a few years ago, and he was saying, you know, black audiences needed to grow up. And, you know, I thought it was a pretty good interview, and we kind of debated over a few things, but I really agree with him. I think that, you know, I compare what happened to The Great Debaters and First Sunday with what, you know, oddly enough, happened with Antoine Fisher, you know, Denzel Washington's first directing effort, which opened just before Barbershop, which was another Ice Cube movie. And the same thing happened in terms of the box office appeal, the way the audiences really responded to the movie. And I think that, you know, every now and then, you know, or regularly, I will hear from, you know, readers about how they're really tired of these, you know, movies. They're too ghetto. They're, you know, why can't we have some serious movies? But then, you know, a movie like The Great Debaters is made, and we don't, you know, take our children by the hand and, you know, take our teenagers, especially the movie going audience, by the hand and make them go to this movie on Christmas Day. You know, we let them go to see National Treasure, you know. So I think that, you know, Denzel Washington and Oprah hope that, you know, that we would go as families to see this movie. And that didn't happen, you know. But, you know, all the 13, 14, 15 year olds rushed out to see First Sunday. And I can't blame it all on them. I'm sure there were some, you know, middle aged people in the audience as well. Well,
let me get Professor in here. Professor Cripps, can you really dictate that people need to go see positive films, or is that kind of a lost cause?
Well, the short answer is it's a lost cause. If you think of films that made money, if you look back to 1971 and Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, there was not a positive image in it, except in the vague sense that the character Sweetback, as he's running away from the cops and America, says a badass N-word is coming back to collect some dues. So here's a revolutionary, but he's running off to Mexico. Well, what survived was his character in dozens, maybe hundreds, of so-called blaxploitation movies. And black people race to get to them. So it's a matter of those are going to exist, but you have to do The Debaters and other significant films to rival them, so that smart, learned, educated people who want to pass it on to their children will take their children to them, but they're still going to sneak out and see Sweetback.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about blaxploitation later in our series, but I want to thank you for giving us a foundation. Esther, Professor Cripps, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Esther Iverum wrote We Gotta Have It, 20 Years of Seeing Black at the Movies, 1986 to 2006. She also runs seeingblack.com. And Thomas Cripps is a professor emeritus at Morgan State University. He's also the author of several books, including Black Film as Genre. Political campaigns are blowing up on the web in all kinds of ways right now. So how do you flip the appeal of a website, MySpace page, or text message blast into actual votes? And hey, what's a few billion between friends? Microsoft bids $44.6 billion for the struggling Yahoo. News and Notes tech contributor Mario Armstrong has the latest. Hey, Mario.
Hey, Farai, how are you?
I'm great. I'm not as good as if somebody was offering me $44 billion, but hey.
$44.6 billion, a lot of money.
I know. We're going to talk about that in a second. But first, presidential elections. What sort of content are people creating online around the candidates?
You know, it's everything you can think of and then some. We're just seeing this explosion this through this particular candidacy of really seeing the internet become this factor of everyone from the candidates themselves utilizing, you know, typical websites that Facebook, MySpace and others and just their own building their own web presence, as well as consumers or concerned citizens creating their own spinoffs, their own blogs. And just the ease of access of creating, whether it's a blog or a video sharing website, we're seeing new things like the recent ones is like Ubama. It's youbama.com. It's a spinoff off of YouTube. It's actually a page on YouTube, but it was created by two Stanford students who basically said we wanted to create an online video aggregator for undecided voters that would want to watch some of Barack Obama's supporters' videos. And you're seeing this for other candidates as well. You're also seeing some extreme moves by companies like Advantage Consultants who basically say, hey, we can supply you, Mr. or Ms. Candidate, with an army full of bloggers ready to get your campaign out on the blogosphere 24/7. It's like the Wild Wild West right now on the internet.
Is that, I mean, of course, all's fair in love, war, and politics, but is that cheating in a way? You know, blogs were created initially as this, like, I'm just going to express what's in my heart. And now it sounds as if what you're saying is that there's a lot of people who are saying, I'm going to create the appearance that people are speaking from their heart.
Yeah, you know, and this is gets into astroturfing and a whole bunch of other terminology behind what's the real message of these types of websites. You're right. The organic nature of a blog was to be something that was transparent, that wasn't agenda driven. And obviously, when you start looking at politics and campaigns, it's agenda driven. So now they're looking at these tools being PR machines more than these transparent, here's a look into my life type of outlet that it used to be.
Speaking of transparency, there's some information that campaigns don't always give out, like where their money's coming from. And tell me about Open Secrets.
Yeah, so Open Secrets is this website. OpenSecrets.org is the web address. But they have been tracking online campaigns for quite some time. It's just not online. I should say it's really just the money trail behind campaigns and candidates, whether it's your local candidate or state representatives or, in this case, the presidential candidates. You can really get access to what is already publicly accessible information but very hard to find through today's means. Open Secrets has been able to aggregate all of that data, who the personal interests are, who the donors are, where they're coming from, and really give you a picture as to how the money may be impacting policy or impacting who's doing what and where.
Now, if you're someone who's working at a company, running a company, running a little nonprofit, what can you learn from all these technological approaches that the candidates are using?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, there are a lot of lessons to be learned as you really look at the campaigns. I mean, number one, if you are a nonprofit, you obviously need fundraising. Well, we've seen this model now. You can go back to Howard Dean and come up to now where we've seen what donations online can do. And it's easier than ever to try to create that on your website. You have to create that presence. Number two, using online video to get your message out, to generate more activism, to get volunteers and people engaged in your mission. And then number three, really understanding things like Facebook and MySpace and Collective X. That's a type of social network for nonprofit organizations. And then lastly, using cell phones. A lot of people are carrying cell phones. I say in this country, we carry three things, a wallet, keys, and a cell phone. And now there's a new technology. It's been around for a while, but now being utilized in political landscape and nonprofit landscape is twittering. And we can explain that later, but it's a type of text messaging. And so all of these things are proven effective in the presidential candidacy, should also bode well for nonprofit organizations.
All right. We're not going to have time to Twitter right now. We can Twitter later.
cool.
All we got time for is one quick question. Why does Bill Gates want to buy Yahoo?
Because they need to. They need to become the number two search engine in the world. Google is number one. Microsoft MSN's portal is a lame duck in the number three position. This would give them a better search engine opportunity, which would increase the amount of online advertising dollars, which is where everyone is going and why this would make a lot of sense to do.
So are they going to take the offer, you think?
You know, I hope so. It would be nice to see. You know, I would like to see Yahoo stay independent, but I don't know. I mean, they're talking about 1,000 layoffs, Farai. So if it can stop people from losing their job, I'm all for it.
All right. Well, Mario, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Farai.
Mario Armstrong is our News and Notes tech contributor.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music. Upon a broken guitar.